Check out my new book, Reach All Readers, at reachallreaders.com. When you pre-order, you'll get special access to my Science of Reading mini course. Learn more at reachallreaders.com. Hello, Anna Geiger here from The Measured Mom, and in today's episode, I got to speak with Lynn Stone. Lynn Stone is the author of three books, Reading for Life, Spelling for Life, and Language for Life. She also offers many online courses, and she's an international speaker, and she's also an instructor. So she spent many years teaching the kids who really, really struggle with reading, writing, and spelling. And it was a true privilege and honor to be able to speak with her. I actually saw her speak at the Reading League event in October of 2023. And I don't know if my American friends who are listening remember that day when we had the emergency broadcast system, the national thing, like the first time we've ever had this happen everywhere and everybody's phones were beeping like at the same time. That happened to be during her 1 hour presentation that she flew across the world to give because she lives in Australia. And she was a very good sport about that. It was a great presentation. And she was also a very good sport when we had some connection issues while recording this podcast. And I made my old mistake of not choosing the correct microphone, but Lynn is very clear and always articulate. So I know you'll get a lot out of this. I just want to say up front that Lynn has some different opinions than other people. There's definitely different ideas in the science of reading community surrounding things like the idea of teaching blends and the idea of teaching syllable types. So I wanted to address those and let you hear from Lynn and hear her perspective. In today's episode, we really work through how to teach English spelling, even though it's a complex system. So I hope you enjoy, and here we go.
Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you.
So I've read all your books, and I've taken most of your courses, and just this past October, I got to hear you speak in real life at the Reading League conference in New York, and even got a picture with you on the sidewalk. So I'm really excited to be able to talk about spelling with you today. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast. If you could start by introducing yourself. Tell us about how you got into education.
Okay. So I'm a linguist, which means that I studied the structure of language at university. And when I graduated, I went over to Australia. So I studied in London at UCL and University College London. And then I graduated and went over to Australia. And I got a job at a Lindemood Bell Clinic in Sydney. And I was trained in what they called the AD program then, but it's now called LIPS. The Lindemoods were one of the first people to actually talk about phonological awareness and how important that was for literacy acquisition. So I did a lot of very in-depth phonological and phonemic awareness work with children and adults who were struggling to read and write. And I learned all of their stuff and sort of moved up the ranks a little bit. But then they left Australia. And so I cast around for another job and found a job in a speech pathology clinic. And that's where I learned Spalding. So that's one of those classic OG programs. And I learned that and then did that day in, day out, combined with LIPS and so on for a few years. I kept finding gaps, though, in the programs, especially for children who were really struggling. And so I started to write solutions to those gaps. And that became Spelling for Life. It became Language for Life, which is to do with grammar and syntax. That's basically my history. It is a tier three built career. I still have a practice, but now I have staff running that practice. And what I do now is I consult to schools. So I fly around everywhere and I work with systems rather than individuals while my staff at home, you know, keep the home fires burning and see individuals and small groups of struggling children and adults.
Interesting. So in your work with schools, what specific things are you doing?
So what schools will do is they'll contact me and say, we're starting or we're halfway through or we're at this point on our science of reading, science of learning journey, and we want to improve things. Can you help us? So what I do is I act as a critical friend, a thought partner. I'll train their staff. I'll do whatever it is that they need to take the next step towards a more research-informed approach to teaching literacy. And it sends me all around the world. I'm very, very lucky. And I'm very lucky to work with such dedicated schools as well. It gives me huge hope for the future of education.
Yeah. So how long have you been doing the consulting work?
On and off for quite a long time, over a decade, but I've now really focused on that. I do consulting and I also run professional development. And from that professional development, then there'll be more consulting and so on. So I've actually trained two other consultants. That's how big it's getting. And in 2024, they'll be on board as well, doing consultancy work. So yeah, it's at least over a decade. And I've been running professional development though since, gosh, it's got to be since the late 90s.
Oh wow,
it's actually really scary. That's right. But yeah, but there you go.
So spelling, I know, is one of your passions, and you have such a fun way of talking about spelling in your book. And in the beginning, you talk about spelling as being much maligned and misunderstood. Can you explain why you wrote that?
Well, the English spelling system is complex. We know that, right? The migration patterns in England and Britain for the last 2,000 years have been really, you know, complex. So there's a lot of words, and it has a lot of influence. And because of that, it's not a transparent system. So we've got 26 letters and so many words that we have to spell with those letters, that the system has grown to be have complexity. And because of that, and because teachers are not really given the tools to teach that well from the beginning, then what happens is it gets this reputation for being somehow crazy, irregular, weird, you know, and that's not true. It's actually a really, really elegant system. But it's a complex one. And it's one also, and you know, with any alphabetic system, it's one that some human brains don't take to very well. Dyslexic people find it difficult to wrestle with print, and English is particularly difficult for them. So it gets maligned that way, and it gets misunderstood because it's not actually crazy at all. It just needs some really deep thought and good training to communicate about that. And even children and adults with dyslexia can get to certain pretty good levels of spelling if they get the right instruction.
And so I think you would say that understanding English spelling includes understanding different layers of language, maybe you would call it that. And we talked about things like, you know, orthography, morphology, etymology. Can you talk about those things and how they relate to spelling?
Yeah, that's what makes it complex, because it's not, here's the alphabet and this letter represents this sound, the end. That would be great if it were transparent like that. And there are lots of languages that are transparent like that. What English has and what makes it complex is that it has orthographic rules that drive it. For instance, things like you don't use the letter CK at the beginning of a word. And so some of the rules are really logical and easy to spot and sort of easy to just understand by osmosis. Like CK, we don't use that at the beginning of words, and people stop doing that quite quickly if they do it at all. But things like, you know, CK at the end of words, you don't precede that with a consonant. You don't precede that with a vowel digraph, typically. These are the orthographic rules that govern that system. And you have to have those rules because, again, we have got so many words with a very small amount of letters. So we have to have sort of ways of mixing them and marking what's pronounced and what's not pronounced and so on. So that's the orthographic layer, and that makes it complex. From that orthographic layer, there is the origin of the words. So we make choices regarding what sequence of letters we have based on where the words came from. So if you've got it's not enough just to listen to the sounds of words. You've also got to know a little bit about the fact that there are stories of words. So if you hear a k at the end of a word, and it's a word derived from French, it's pretty likely that it's going to be Q-U-E, right? So you've got etymological stuff going on there. If you see a PH in a word, it's pretty likely that this is a Greek base somewhere, you know, for a and then there's the morphology as well. And actually all of it is kind of inextricable. But morphological things are you know, things like, well, sometimes it's not just about un and pre and the letter S and the letter ED and the letter ING. Morphology also works in tandem with spelling, and you have things like changes at morphemic boundaries. So you've got things like the word act But if you add the suffix ion, now you've got a pronunciation change, action, right? It's not action, because that's actually inefficient to say. So there's, all of these layers that can be systematically taught, and they definitely can be integrated. And it's always my goal to try and help teachers to do that effectively.
I think you call them exceptional words in your book, is that right? Like words that we might consider irregular?
I don't really name them. What I do say
Okay.
is, so there is a word stories wheel that we have in there, and within that wheel it says this word is exceptional because, that word isn't doing what you'd expect it to do. But there's always a reason why a letter sequence doesn't appear as you'd expect it. And that's a concept that's worth exploring. So in Spelling for Life, I talk about this. There's seven major reasons. However, a caveat, those are the stories and they're fun, but it's the practice that makes the difference. It's how you practice. And I know we are going to come up to a question about practice as well. Sometimes we can get caught up in, showcasing our amazing etymological knowledge, and not planning for the practice. So spelling practice is really, really important. So yes, definitely talk about the stories of words, but don't make that everything you do, because that's not the bit that they remember or the bit that they have to remember. What they have to remember is that sequence. So tell them the why once. It's a bit like comprehension strategies. You can tell them how to do it a few times, but you've got to get down to actually wrestling with the thing, right? So
Just this is not a sub a question that I had submitted beforehand, but I would like to talk to you about your feeling about spelling rules and what rules you feel are worth teaching and how you feel about that. Like, do you feel like that students should be able to say the rule to apply it, or there's just a lot of different opinions about that in the science of reading world.
Let's start with a broad view. Let's start with the overview. And the overview is this: spelling, English orthography, is a system. And that system is governed by rules. It has conventions. So whether you use the term rules or not, you're using them and you know them. If you have a lexicon and you can instantly and effortlessly retrieve words for spelling, you know the rules. Whether you can say them or whether you can't say them, they exist. And you know them, right? So that's our broad view. So these things exist, these conventions. It's not a dirty free for all, right? That's the first thing about spelling. So therefore, you as an adult with a complete lexicon, say if you're an educator, and you've done it, you've achieved it, you know how to spell, why would you keep that from people, right? Why would you keep it from them? Because not everyone is just going to learn this through exposure to print. Not everybody is going to learn this through osmosis, right? Why not tell them how it works? Because if you tell everyone how it works, you're going to bring everyone along with you. So, of course, teach the rules. Now, what does that actually mean? It doesn't mean I want a bunch of children in a classroom to be able to parrot stuff. That's not. That's saying the rules exist, but it doesn't say how to use them. What I want is for children to have enough of a rationale around the system, and that includes irregularities, and it includes, some technical terms like vowel and consonant and digraph and final silent E and so on. I want them to have enough of that to be able to make high quality decisions in my absence about letter sequences. That's what I want. And what that comes from is practice, right? Good quality practice.
Well, as long as we're talking about practice, we'll move that question up. Can you talk to us about what good spelling practice looks like and doesn't look like?
Three things are important, I think, when you're practicing spelling. And I'm a good speller, right? So I'm lucky. I've got that sort of brain where I can look at a word and it's in, basically. And that helped me build my lexicon really, really, really fast. Lucky old me, right? I can't park my car straight. I don't count that well, but I can spell like a professional. Okay, so what is it, and I've questioned myself for many years, what is it that I do rather than just use my photographic memory, right? What else, what is it that I do when I struggle with a word? How do I put the words I struggle with, even as a good speller, into my mind? And it is always using three things, right? So therefore, if you're going to practice, these three things even help terrific spellers. The first one is I need to analyze the structure of the word. I need to know why that sequence is that sequence. That helps me remember it when I look at why that is. Yeah. Secondly, I need to look at other words that belong in that family. So whatever it is that's bothering me about the sequence, if I put that with other words, with, you know, that where they have kinships, I'm more likely to be able to retrieve that word. But thirdly, I have a spelling voice. I have a spelling voice.
Yes.
And I use my spelling voice. So I will say skizzers. I will say Wednesday. I will say O-N-E-1. My spelling voice varies depending on what I'm trying to remember, right? So sometimes I'll say the letter names. Sometimes I'll overpronounce everything. So I'll make sure I don't use schwa, because that's not my spelling voice, you know? So confer, say Sean, right? That's my spelling voice, no Sean. So those three things, spelling voice, structure, families, that helps good spellers remember. It also helps struggling spellers remember. So
what are some things that people should not do?
Well, I wrote a whole thing on that.
yes.
In a peer-reviewed journal. About spelling activities toxic to useful, with a big sort of area in the middle called useless. So
okay.
So if we go right down to toxic, basically I call them toxic because they'll make you a worse speller. They'll impede your progress while you are trying to build your lexicon. And it's things like, you know, activities involving staring at the words. It's incredibly passive, waste of your time, and you know, just doesn't work. Mixing up the order of letters, that's insane, right? It's the sequence. You've got to remember the sequence. If you're focusing on something that's out of sequence, well, as Anita Archer says, practice makes permanent. Not perfect, but permanent. So you better practice that sequence as it is, not as it's not. So those are things like, you know, jumble up the letters and focusing on the visual aspects of words. It's not your visual memory that's helping you retrieve those words from long-term memory. It's different structures there. So, you know, we're really off the path sometimes when we do activities that involve staring at words, drawing lines around them, around their shape. I call them word coffins, just again focusing on visual features. That's not how we remember words. So today might be the day you don't do that if you do that.
So you have some opinions on certain things that are maybe common practice in some programs, so maybe you could speak to your feelings about teaching blends. People call them sometimes consonant clusters, but groups of consonants that come together in words that each have their own sound. Can you speak to your feelings about that?
Well, what they are is kind of lifeless zombies, because if you teach consonant clusters as one unit, you're neither teaching a grapheme nor a phoneme nor a morpheme, right? You're not teaching any of these things that are actually the units of language. If you're teaching these consonant clusters, and I don't want to even call them blends, because the act of blending is really, really useful for learning to read. The act of blending graphemes and phonemes together to form words is really useful. But a blend, you know, like in the word blend, that starts with a B and an L and it ends with an N and a D. So it's got, you know, bookends of blends. If you teach those as units, firstly, you've got to then cover hundreds of linguistic units that children now have to somehow memorize. And there's no hook to hang these things on. There's no morpheme there. There's two phonemes. There's two graphemes. It's a lot to remember, and you will overwhelm a lot of children. Secondly, if you teach blends And then you get children to, and I see this all the time, you get children to write a word like, say, the word blend, right? And you're telling them to sound it out. A lot of children will write the B and they'll go bull and then end, and they'll write bend because there's too much information in that tiny unit of time. So I see this all the time, missing persons, I call them, you know, disappearing consonants from these clusters because they don't have sufficient knowledge and time to sound all that out properly. So it's just not, linguistically, it doesn't make sense to do that. What does make sense is that actually L and R are two of the letters that occupy that secondary position most. And that's because of their pronunciation, right? It's a good idea to tell children that. That's a great idea, you know. And the letter S goes with lots of things. Again, because when we say it, we can then move to lots of different consonant places. And that's a little bit more, I think, linguistically accurate and interesting and usable than teaching these zombies that are neither graphemes, phonemes, nor morphemes.
So I think sometimes, like when I first heard people like you talk about not teaching blends, as they're often called, I thought I misunderstood that, I think, at first, because you're not saying not to teach kids to read CCVCC words. Mm. You're just emphasizing that those two letters should not be taught as an individual unit. And I think that might be confusing some people. Do you have any specific suggestions for teaching kids to spell, to not make that mistake, as you were saying, of dropping the second letter of the whatever you want to call it, if you don't want to call it a blend?
Yeah. Look, consonant clusters are difficult. So once you've mastered your CVC, you can start bringing in consonant clusters for sure. I have an exercise that I do with kids in Spelling for Life, where they actually, it's called a consonant start card and a consonant end card. And what they do is over time, they will, almost like an inquiry, dare I say it, right? An inquiry based project where they get all the consonants and they go, okay, what goes with what? And that analysis is really helpful as well, because they form the conclusion, oh, it's L and R, right, okay. And, oh, look, okay. S goes with lots of things. That's an approach that's a lot more helpful than learn these pieces of code.
Okay.
You know, it just makes a lot more sense, I think, to turn them into linguists rather than just giving them more stuff to memorize with no rationale.
Sure. And can you speak to your opinion about syllable types?
Yeah. Again, if we're in zombie territory again. We're in zombie territory when we talk about syllable types. Most words in English are polysyllabic, right? And of those polysyllabic words, they will consist of a base and some affixes, right? That's really what makes the polysyllabic words the polysyllabic words. There are some exceptions, of course, but let's talk about the majority. Because again, like we said at the beginning, when you're teaching 30 to 70,000 words, or when you need to acquire 30 to 70,000 words so that you can go on and have an academic career, you know, you can go to university or whatever, then you can't teach it word by word. You've got to teach good examples. So the good examples are the polysyllabic words that consist of bases and affixes, right? Because that's the majority of the words. Syllable types are neither, they're not bases and affixes. They're just an over-analysis. There's a kind of, you know, they're lifeless zombies again. They don't connect to any meaning. They're very difficult to generalize. And they're mostly not true as well. They don't really form typical patterns, if you like. Even open closed syllable only works about 60% of the time. When you get into polysyllabic territory, you've got this thing that we do in English called stress. You know, we're stress time language, so, and vowel reduction. So you're going to schwa lots of those syllables as well. Better to have the stable morphemes understood and learned than a so-called syllable type that tells you nothing except maybe how to pronounce a word fairly reliable. This language is not about pronunciation, right? That's part of it, but to be able to make robust mental orthographic images of words so that you can retrieve them effortlessly, so that you can then be automatic in your writing, so that you can be strategic in your writing, you're going to have to understand the morphemes and, you know, and be able to use them well. Syllable types are not that. Again, it's just inefficient.
So I know the schwa intrudes a lot, which does make it very difficult when using syllable types to pronounce syllables. Yeah. Can you explain? I know you talked about how you have use your spelling voice to help kids spell words. So, like, if they're spelling the word cactus, their spelling voice would be cactus. Any other tips for teaching spelling with schwa, because that does get so tricky?
Well, the first thing is to understand what schwa is as an educator. So it's not something that you necessarily have to make children be able to do, you know, write that upside down E properly. And so that's a little bit too much overkill. But as an educator, if you think about it, what we have is speech and then we've got writing, and they're two different beasts. Now, in speech, what we do is we reduce vowels. We do that so that we don't sound robotic, right? English is a stress-timed language, okay. So it tries to keep regular intervals between strong syllables in words. That's what makes English sound like English. To do that, we reduce the quality of the vowels in polysyllabic words, and even in our, in our speech, like even the word was, right? When you say it in isolation, it's was, but in speech, a lot of the time, it's just was. Right? You're reducing that vowel. That's what we do in a stress-timed language. So that makes it kind of hard to spell if the only tool in your toolbox is sound it out, right? It makes it hard to spell, because as soon as schwa comes along, all hell breaks loose, because there is no schwa vowel in spelling. It's A, E, I, O, or U. So that's the problem, right? The solution is spelling voice and understanding morphemes as well. Morphemes are spelled stably. They are stable, whether it's re or r, you know, like respond. We don't say respond, right? We say respond, but it always spell re, right? They're really nice and stable, and they obey the rules as well. So you have suffixing conventions and you have assimilated prefixes. Knowing that and teaching that, no matter how you say the words, will help you spell the words.
So for teachers who might want to know more about that, because I know I've seen presentations you've given, like the one I saw in person and then the ones I see online, and you talk about, you know, using the morphemes to help with the spelling. And so much of the time I think, well, I don't know all those morphemes yet. So how do teachers do this when they're...
Sorry.
Yeah, right. I know it goes on forever and ever. But for teachers who want to get started and feel like my knowledge of morphemes is small, is there a particular reference or lesson plans or things that can help them get started there?
Well, luckily, we are not under-resourced when it comes to morphological stuff, if you like. Well, we're not under-resourced at all. I have a morphology masterclass for beginners. William Van Cleave does some sterling work on this stuff. You've got these groups, structured word inquiry groups on social media that meet and are incredibly generous with their time and understanding. There are lots and lots of places to go. And I think structured word inquiry is a really good starting point for lots and lots of people, because it helps you dip your toe in the way that it says, just start with a word, any word, right? And you start to get, you know, you become addicted to morphology at some point from that starting point. So I would definitely point people in that direction. There's also a book that I absolutely love, two of them. One's called Back Pocket Words by Gail Venable. Wonderful. That's all about conversations about, she selected a bunch of words and said, have them in your back pocket, because that's going to help you to become more morphologically aware and therefore, you know, more morphologically proficient so that you can teach that to students. So Back Pocket Words, brilliant book. And then Beneath the Surface of Words. Oh, I love that book. It teaches me, that's Sue Hegland. It teaches me so much. Or it's taught me so much. Oh, you've got the book there, yeah. Really good places to start.
I'm reading Beneath the Surface of Words right now, and the other one is next on my list. And It's really fun. Like, I do love words, but there's so many things in there I've never considered. And the one that struck me the most was the root cave, if it's pronounced cave, and then how that goes into cavity. Like, I just never connected cavern and cavity before. That was fascinating to me.
Concave and
Yeah, it's super interesting.
It just reveals so many things and things that you have never thought about. And I think also what it does, and this is a message I really want to get out to teachers if they're considering, moving to more morphologically, etymologically, orthographically based approaches, is that it's an absolute no shame zone. You don't have to carry all of this information around in your head. So what, however you start and what, wherever you have a go, that's better than not doing it, and you will be accepted into a really wide community of people who are non-judgmental about all of this. I mean, I've made a ton of mistakes with morphology in my time. It's something, but I'm not ashamed. I'm just glad I was there and did it. And I'd love to kind of spread that message as well, because kids dig it and they remember it, and the benefits of it are so far-reaching. Why wouldn't you? So the message is, don't be afraid. Do this.
Yeah, and like you said, it is once you start to learn it, you start to see how much spelling has to do with morphology in so many ways. And like you said, because the pronunciation changes, but we can see that morpheme is there. So I will be sure to share some resources in the show notes, including your morphology masterclass, which is the one I haven't taken yet, but that is on my list. Anything else you'd like to share? Resources that you have or projects you're working on that you'd like people to know about?
Well, in 2024, 2024 is the Chinese year of the dragon, right? And I've always used dragons in my resources. I've always had little pictures of dragons, and you've got the decoding dragon that you can download, and teachers pay teachers for free. And I have I've sort of formalized the approach to word study that we use at Lifelong Literacy called the four-step process. And one of the things that I've done that we'll be releasing in 2024 is that all of the pictures to do with what you do at every step of the four-step process to study words is a dragon, right? Doing what four-step process. So that's going to be formally released next year as a four-step process kit. And we'll be doing, we'll be updating the four-step process resources. And yeah, tw so 2024 really is the year of word study via the four-step process and all the dragons. That's what's coming.
Okay, well, that's really exciting. Great. I can't wait. I've seen that. I think you shared that four-step process in the workshop that I saw in New York. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to have fun finding things to share in the show notes because there's so many things that you've resources that you've shared online and all kinds of things. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come talk to us.
Always a huge pleasure. Love your work.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find the show notes for today's episode at themeasuredmom.com/episode154. Talk to you next time.
That's all for this episode of Triple R Teaching. For more educational resources, visit Anna at her home base, themeasuredmom.com, and join our teaching community. We look forward to helping you reflect, refine, and recharge on the next episode of Triple R Teaching.